So we'll call the meeting to order. I noticed yesterday that there was a high regard for the reception. At least one person, maybe more than one, ate about a dozen of those sliders. We're going to have a reception if we are doing this next year, which I imagine we should. So you can get ready, and we'll make more sliders next year. I think we ran out. First item this morning is disability rights as constitutional rights. And we have two people to make presentations before the time for questions. Ruth Kolker is Distinguished University Professor and Heckfast Memorial Chair in Constitutional Law at Ohio State University, Moritz College of Law. She is nationally recognized as a leading scholar in the areas of constitutional law and disability discrimination. Before joining the faculty at Ohio State, Professor Kolker taught at Tulane University, the University of Toronto, the University of Pittsburgh, and at George Washington University. She also spent 4 years as a trial attorney in the Civil Rights Division of the United States Department of Justice. For the first presentation, here is Professor Kolker.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm really honored to be here. I hear that yesterday was a fabulous day, and I wish I could have been here for yesterday. So I'm sort of at a disadvantage in that I don't know what all the great conversations that happened yesterday, but I'm going to try to be as useful as I can be this morning. I know that each of you come to this conference from different perspectives and experiences and interest, and one of my challenges is to figure out how to pitch this talk so that it's useful to all of you, and I'll do my best to do that. What I'm going to do today is talk a little bit about the lack of constitutional protection in the disability law area, and I'm going to sort of set the stage for Bob talking about where we might go next in trying to use the very scanty, limited constitutional law that does exist in this area. Some of you are very familiar with the lack of constitutional protections for people with disabilities. Others of you may not be so aware, so I'm going to try to put us all at the same playing field, which will help Bob then to discuss this issue further. One of the challenges in talking about the constitutional protections for individuals with disabilities is that the phrase individual with disabilities doesn't actually exist constitutionally. The courts have dealt with discrete claims by individuals who have discrete disabilities and have ruled against them or in their favor, but really hasn't ever discussed the sort of generic category individuals with disabilities in a way that's meaningful and useful. So we have a linguistic problem just at the beginning that I'm going to be talking about something that doesn't really exist as a concept. What I'll do is talk about some of the leading cases in the area involving discrete individuals with various types of disabilities, and you can see the path, the general trend, which is for the court to deny the existence of any significant constitutional protection for this group. So the place that one usually starts in having a discussion about the constitutional rights of individuals with disabilities is Buck versus Bell. A case that many of you have probably heard of that had to do with the involuntary sterilization of individuals because of alleged insanity or in their families. And in that case, in 1927, Justice Holmes upheld that state statute in which he said rather famously, and I quote, "Three generations of imbeciles are enough." Not the most disability-friendly statement we've ever heard from the courts. And as I said, that was for a state statute that provided for the involuntary sterilization of, quote, "any patient afflicted with hereditary forms of insanity or imbecility," whatever that is. So that Virginia statute was finally repealed in 1974. So it's that's not that long ago. Many of us were alive at that point. The opinion has not been ever explicitly overruled. It was even cited with approval in Roe versus Wade in 1973, although most states have put in place procedural protections for individuals who face involuntary sterilization. So that's sort of the beginning, which isn't much of a good beginning for people with disabilities. And that was a case involving an individual with alleged intellectual impairments. So time passes, quite a bit of time passes, and the next big Supreme Court case that was the City of Cleburne versus Cleburne Living Center, which is a 1985 case. In that case, a Texas city denied a special use permit for the operation of a group home for individuals who are intellectually disabled, acting pursuant to a municipal zoning ordinance requiring special permits for, and I quote, hospitals for the insane or feeble-minded or alcoholic or drug addicts or penal or correctional institutions. And what I always love about these cases is, you know, the legislature is very clear with their stereotypes and prejudice, right? They don't try to hide it. So, you know, in Buck versus Bell, we have that famous great language, insanity or imbecility. Here we have lumping together, as if they all have something in common, those who need to be in a so-called hospital for the insane or feeble-minded, and they're grouped with alcoholic or drug addicts, as well as those who are in penal or correctional institutions. You know, so we can just see where the legislature is coming from. In that particular situation, it was actually a group home. It wasn't what we would usually think of as a hospital. But the zoning commission felt that their rules applied to a group home. And they said that this facility, this group home, should be classified as a, quote, hospital for the feeble-minded. It was actually a group home for individuals with intellectual impairments. So they held their hearing, and you can probably all imagine what the testimony was at the hearing. It was a not-in-my-own-backyard type of proceeding. So after it heard the local testimony, the city council voted 3-1 to deny the special use permit. The case is then challenged as being an unconstitutional deprivation of the rights of these people who want to live together. And the Fifth Circuit, in one of the most liberal disability rights cases ever authored by a court, not only held that the city council had acted unconstitutionally, but also held that that group of individuals should get strict scrutiny, the most rigid standard of scrutiny that we apply under constitutional law, the standard of scrutiny that we apply to race-based claims of discrimination. And that was really the sort of high mark of courts treating disability issues as important and ones that they should take a strong role in monitoring to help avoid disability discrimination in our society. The Supreme Court of the United States did agree that the city had acted unconstitutionally, but it overturned that part of the Fifth Circuit's decision that it held that there should be suspect class or strict scrutiny treatment. And this is what the Supreme Court said to justify that position. It said, because mental retardation is a characteristic that the government may legitimately take into account in a wide range of decisions, and because both state and federal governments have recently committed themselves to assisting the retarded, we will not presume that any given legislative action, even one that disadvantages retarded individuals, is rooted in considerations that the Constitution will not tolerate. So what the court basically said is, the legislature is beginning to do a pretty good job here. We don't want to be second-guessing their judgments. And, you know, out of the sort of view of paternalism, they said, us, the courts, we don't have to intervene. We don't have to second-guess these legislative judgments because we have the utmost confidence the legislative process works well for these individuals. And so the court only used the lowest level of scrutiny, what we call rational basis scrutiny, and said even under that lowest level of scrutiny, what the city did there was wholly irrational. There was no good reasons to subject this group home to a higher standard than you would subject any other kind of living situation, and found that that action was unconstitutional. So constitutional law scholars, starting in 1985, after that decision was decided, read the City of Cleburne case, and many people said, well, the Supreme Court didn't mean what it said. It didn't really mean that only rational basis scrutiny applies there. They really were trying to put some bite into the scrutiny that applies when individuals' constitutional rights are violated and they're disabled. But they didn't. There was no need to say so because that statute was so ridiculous and so wholly irrational. So that was the view that was contained in many of the con law books that I've taught from, that a lot of people thought, well, we should just re-understand City of Cleburne. The court didn't really say what it meant. So that was a perfectly reasonable way to proceed until the court became more clear in recent years and said, no, they meant that, and we still think that's the right idea. The issue came before the United States Supreme Court again in the year 2001, where the court was looking at my favorite statute, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and trying to figure out if the ADA was constitutional in the limited sense of whether it constitutionally allowed a cause of action for monetary damages when a private individual sues a state. That's a very technical, esoteric problem in constitutional law, but that very narrow question, can a private individual sue a state for monetary damages under the ADA? Does the ADA constitutionally reach that kind of action? And the Supreme Court said no, the ADA was unconstitutional in allowing for that form of relief. And in explaining its decision, it said, look, everybody, City of Cleburne says that mere rational basis scrutiny attaches in the disability constitutional law area. And they re-quoted some language from City of Cleburne just in case we didn't get it the first time. So in 2001, the Supreme Court said, if the large and amorphous class of the mentally retarded were deemed quasi-suspect for the reasons given by the Court of Appeals in City of Cleburne, it would be difficult to find a principled way to distinguish a variety of other groups who have perhaps immutable disabilities, setting them off from others who cannot themselves mandate the desired legislative responses and who can claim such degree of prejudice from at least part of the public at large. One need mention in this respect only the aging, the disabled, the mentally ill, and the infirm. We are reluctant to set out on that course, and we decline to do so. So that's language from City of Cleburne from the 1980s. The Supreme Court cites that language again with approval in 2001, making it clear that they don't want to think about the category of individuals with disabilities as being a meaningful category, one that triggers heightened constitutional protection. So this is a problem that is with us today. The only slightly good news, and this is what Bob is going to talk about, he's today the glass half full, and I'm the glass half empty, although typically I'm a glass half full person, but I'll try to do this as well as I can. The only glimmer of good news was in 2004 when the Supreme Court was asked to consider the constitutionality of ADA Title II, a second part, another provision of the ADA, with respect to non-employment claims that might be brought by individuals against the state. The court said, well, okay, just because Congress exceeded its authority when it provided this cause of action under ADA Title I, maybe it hasn't exceeded its authority with respect to other kinds of claims of discrimination, non-employment claims under ADA Title II. In that particular case, the two plaintiffs were two plaintiffs who claimed that because of their mobility impairments, they were denied access to the judicial system. They couldn't get into the courthouse because the courthouse had stairs and no elevator. And the lead plaintiff, George Lane, had been carried up the stairs to appear at his criminal hearing once and decided never again. He didn't want that again. He didn't want to, be harmed and hurt just to get to this criminal hearing. And so his lawyer, who had never before done any disability rights work, but thought this was wrong, was a criminal defense lawyer, brought this claim on behalf of Mr. Lane. And the Supreme Court, somewhat surprisingly, said, ADA Title II, although it might have places in which it is unconstitutional and reaching, for example, skating rinks that might be run by the state, it is not unconstitutional to the extent that it allows people to have a private cause of action when they're denied access to the judicial system itself. And that's because even though they might not have heightened scrutiny under the Equal Protection Clause, they're still entitled to due process protections such as right to access to the judicial system. So that case left open the question of whether there are other claims that one might make under ADA Title II that, like the claim of Mr. Lane, actually do reach a constitutional level of concern. And the lower courts are right now trying to figure out what Lane means, and there's a lot of cases in the lower courts in which they're wrestling with that issue. Maybe some of you here are litigating some of those cases. One fact pattern that comes up frequently is higher education. When institutions of higher education aren't sufficiently accommodating students, can they bring claims under ADA Title II and seek monetary damages against the state? And there's other kinds of fact patterns as well. But that's, I think, one of the things maybe Bob will talk about. One of my favorite areas to think about in terms of what Lane might mean and what the court might say in the future about the constitutional rights of people with disabilities is voting. I think voting is sort of an important right. I think it's one that is arguably protected by the Constitution and the First Amendment. And I'm disappointed these days that I've seen states be taking steps that are adverse to the rights of many people with disabilities to vote. And I just want to give you one example from Ohio that I helped recently fight, but it's a common problem that you may be seeing in your home state. I don't know what's going on in Maryland in this respect. But one of the big moves that the Republicans are pushing around the country right now is to strengthen voter ID statutes. And in Ohio, they came up with this brand new idea that we should require people, if they want to vote, that they have to show a current driver's license, not even expired one, a current driver's license, a passport, or a military ID if they want to, when they go to the voting booth to vote. If they don't have one of those three things, they can go take themselves to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles and get a special ID at their own expense, of course, and inconvenience. And when I testified against that bill, which I thought would do nothing to enhance voter integrity, but would do a lot to keep people away from voting, very dramatically problematic for college students who often don't have a current driver's license in the state in which they're attending college, it also would have a very negative impact on voters who are visually impaired, because it's pretty rare for a voter who's visually impaired to have a driver's license. And that person may not have found it necessary to get the special ID issued by the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. It might not, of course, have a passport. Not that many Americans have passports. And when I raised this point at the hearing, I was scoffed and, you know, insulted, as which I'm so used to when I testify before a legislative body. Well, Professor Kolker, I didn't know you got into the policy area. Yes, I do. And so one of the people on the panel that I was testifying to said, well, I mean, what's wrong with absentee voting? I mean, these people can just vote absentee if they don't want to show this ID at the voting booth. And I said, oh, really? Well, absentee voting in Ohio is inaccessible to people with visual impairments, so I don't think that really works. And he looked at me like, oh, it isn't? You know. But of course, why would he know? He's just on the panel that's supposed to be thinking about these issues. And so I told them I thought that if they passed that measure, it would be struck down as unconstitutional. Interestingly enough, the Republican Secretary of State in Ohio actually opposed this bill being proposed by other Republicans. Even he admitted that it wasn't going to do anything to deter voting fraud, but would do a lot to deter voting, which I think is an important constitutional right. So that's something that I find of interest, and if other states go in that very narrow, rigid direction that Ohio was going in, maybe we will have to bring some new ADA Title II cases, because this goes beyond sort of what HAVA protects, to challenge these voter ID laws. So that's where I'm going to leave off, and Bob will continue with this dire story of constitutional law.
Our next person to present this morning is a person who's been with us in the past in these and has worked on our committee to put the Disability Law Symposium, the Jacobus Tenbrook Disability Law Symposium together. This is Robert Dinnerstein. He is a professor of law. He's director of clinical program and director of the Disability Rights Law Clinic at the American University Washington College of Law, where he has taught since 1983. Bob, I first looked at that and I thought it said 1938. Prior to joining the faculty at American University, Professor Dinnerstein worked as an attorney in the Special Litigation Section of the Civil Rights Division at the United States Department of Justice. Here is Bob Dinnerstein.
Thank you, Dr. Maurer. And it is really an honor to be here at at this the fourth, I guess, symposium. I think when we started meeting as a steering committee, I'm not sure any of us could have imagined that it would take off as often as well as it has and become such an important moment in each year, I think, that people look forward to for the opportunity not only to hear from, you know, gas bags like me, but also to talk among yourselves about really the issues and kind of at an important level. So I'm really pleased to be here. And I just was playing around this morning before my computer died with what should I call this talk, and I decided to follow that great disability rights advocate, Tina Turner, who a version of her song, which I'm calling this talk, What's the Constitution Got to Do with It? The Essential Irrelevance of the Constitution for People with Disabilities and the Reasons for Its Modest Revival. And it's really the modest revival part that I guess I'm going to mostly focus on. Let me also just say that in saying, and I agree completely with everything that Ruth said, as I usually do, being on the steering committee, I made sure she was listed first in the program, that it's ironic to be here at a Tenbroek symposium. Tenbroek, who was so important in so many ways, as we know, in disability law, but also in constitutional law. Tenbroek, who essentially created the concept of over-inclusive and under-inclusive categories as being a way to test equal protection. Ironic, therefore, for us to be saying that, unfortunately, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, the Equal Protection Clause provides little direct support for anti-discrimination efforts against people with disabilities, and that's really unfortunate. It didn't have to happen that way, as they say, but it did happen that way. And so, as Ruth said, the way that the jurisprudence was developing and did develop up through Garrett in 2001 was essentially to say, well, maybe de facto there was some kind of heightened attention to equal protection issues for people with disabilities, but whatever thought of rational basis would bite, whatever that might have meant, was pretty much scotched with in the Garrett case. There's complexities to the Garrett case that even Ruth's very full recitation can't get into, nor can I, in terms of why that particularly matters. But let's just say, if you take it on faith, that rendering of the level of scrutiny that the court would give to congressional enactments, including the ADA, was a very big limitation on what Congress could do. By the way, I always want to point this out. A colleague of mine went back years ago and looked at Buck versus Bell and concluded that even on its own terms, Justice Holmes was wrong, because Carrie Buck, who, as I'm sure you know, actually was not in fact feeble-minded, to use the term. It wasn't really three generations of imbeciles. He probably should have said idiots, again, one of the other awful terms from that era. So perhaps the case could be challenged just on his terminology. I want to say something else just a little bit about Cleburne, because there's a piece of it that I think really shows how disappointing the Cleburne to Garrett trajectory was, before getting into where we can go from here. In Cleburne, the court essentially said, look, the courts have sometimes had to come up with ways of figuring out what standard to apply in looking at equal protection cases. And because often there's no guidance from Congress, we have to make it up, essentially. They didn't quite say it that way, but that's what they meant. So that's why we've come up with heightened scrutiny and quasi-heightened scrutiny, all these terms which are really judge-made terms. And in Cleburne, the court said, absent controlling congressional direction, courts have had to figure out what level of scrutiny to apply. And as Ruth correctly indicated, in Cleburne, they said they were only applying the lowest level, rational basis. In fact, they clearly did much more than rational basis review would suggest. Well, Cleburne, 1985. The ADA passed in 1990. The ADA, with its findings at the beginning of the ADA, had at that time, it's no longer in the law, which is interesting, a finding which was essentially a plagiarism, intentional, of the very famous Caroline Products footnote 4. This is inside baseball stuff for you non-lawyers, but let me just say that was the case where the Supreme Court said that discrete and insular minorities, that there has to be particular attention to legislative and other enactments that address, that could be affecting people who are discrete and insular minorities. Congress could not have been more clear than saying, we think people with disabilities, not any particular disability, but all disabilities, need to have their and congressional enactments and other kinds of policies have to be looked at with an eye towards the heightened scrutiny. They were very clear about that. Well, I think, and many others thought that's exactly the kind of controlling congressional direction that the courts should be looking to. The courts could say, we're now not quite off on a frolic of our own. We're actually responding to what Congress did. But that's not what the court did. The court, through another series of cases leading to a case called City of Bernie, essentially said, Congress does not get to create that standard review. We get to create it, and we think it's rational basis. Can't you guys read? Because that's what we said in Cleburne. Watch what we wrote, not what we did, I guess was the message there. So in a sense, that was a real failure, I think. On the merits, a poor decision, but a failure to kind of take the guidance that Cleburne actually tried to provide to say, let's, in this dialogue between the judiciary and the legislative branch, let's figure out what we should be doing. Instead, they rejected that and said, we're only going to look at rational basis review, which has meant, therefore, that in looking at what Congress did in the ADA, the court has used a microscope to try to say, well, you know, you guys have pointed to problems, but the problems are not significant enough. And the famous line from Garrett where the court says, employers, for example, who do not want to hire somebody who might require reasonable accommodation are entitled under the Constitution to be not only hard-headed, but hard-hearted. So they were not mincing words and saying that essentially, in their judgment, the ADA in Title I, the employment title, went beyond what the Constitution would require. And because it went beyond it, and because in the City of Bernie case, the court said you can go a little beyond it, as long as what you're doing is congruent and proportional to the underlying constitutional right, but you went too far beyond it. So that was it for Title I. And I think many people thought, well, the rationale that Title I is not going to be able to permit damage actions probably is going to apply to Title II. But as Ruth pointed out, the court varied from that in Tennessee versus Lane and said, actually, well, under Title II, the state and local services title of the ADA, under at least with respect to fundamental rights, there may be adequate congressional authority for Congress to have acted, and indeed said that. And Michael Waterstone's in the audience, and he's written quite a bit in a wonderful article about what, you know, why Lane is different from what the court did in Garrett and what people might want to do after that. Now, I should say, another one of my things that I think is always kind of interesting in the thought about which are the Title II rights that are fundamental, which are not, is, I don't know about you, but I've not seen in my life a whole lot of state-operated and owned hockey and ice skating rinks. I mean, it seemed to be on the court's mind. I don't know, maybe Justice Kennedy had sort of tripped in an early hockey game in his career, because Ohio, maybe that's what it is. But it's sort of like, okay, so what do we know about what's going to fly under Title II and what's not? Well, in Lane, the court said that access to courts, that's a fundamental value. And because it's a fundamental value, and again, I'm skipping a lot of the internal analysis of it, but because it's a fundamental value, a fundamental right, then Congress has relatively greater authority to act in that area. And the court said that it was acting adequately and with adequate constitutional basis with respect to that. And then the question is, well, what are the other kind of fundamental rights? What else might follow? So I think the reference to voting, which I know is also one of the workshops that's following this, is a great one. Voting would seem to be, if not more important than access to courts, at least as important. In some cases, there's a very strong argument to say that voting is of such crucial importance that it is the kind of right which Congress would have a great deal of authority to legislate in and consequently would justify efforts in the ADA to limit discrimination against people with disabilities. Now, I should say at the oral argument, Mark Sharmitz is in the audience, and Mark and I usually meet once or twice a year when the Supreme Court is doing some damage on disability law. And I remember that oral argument where Chief Justice Rehnquist, he with the significant back problem, didn't seem to think it was any particularly big idea if there happened to be a voting booth that was on the second floor of a building that didn't have an elevator, and that, well, that doesn't mean you're denied the right to vote. It just means you have to find some other way to get up there. And I guess, unlike George Lane, he might have thought that crawling up the stairs would have been an adequate way. So he had a very limited sense of what access to voting would be. Most people, I think, would take a more common sense view that if your vote, if your polling place is inaccessible, if people cannot vote without having somebody help them vote, that could be an issue of access that would be covered. So hockey rinks, no. Access to courts, yes. Voting, yes. And then I think it gets kind of interesting. Voting, I say yes, that is an opinion. The court has not said this yet. The court so far has only, the Supreme Court, has only acted with respect to this issue of access to courts. Now, here's where I think it's doctrinally kind of interesting, and is this question of where the law is going to develop. There's a whole other strand of cases here. law professors love nothing better than to try to tease out this these little skeins of thread. And another line of cases, essentially in the halcyon days of the late 60s and early 70s, the Supreme Court at that time was finding a number of rights that it deemed to be fundamental. And in addition to finding that certain categories under equal protection were entitled to heightened scrutiny, based on race, for example, and national origin, they were also finding certain rights, the right to travel, other rights which they deemed to be so fundamental that, again, congressional or legislative action against that would implicate those rights would have to be looked at with a heightened kind of scrutiny. And then came the 1973 case of San Antonio versus Rodriguez, where the Supreme Court said, education, not fundamental. This might surprise you. You might think education is pretty important. The court said, not fundamental. We're not going down that route. And in a sense, with some variation, that pretty much stopped the development of the fundamental rights branch, if you will, of heightened equal protection and due process analysis, which meant that thereafter you really were looking at the categorical, the issue of race or gender or disability, and not at the issue of how important is the right. Well, now, in a curious kind of way, we're actually beginning to rediscover this kind of jurisprudence. Ruth mentioned the higher education cases. So some of the post-Tennessee versus Lane cases have been in the area of education, where some of the lower courts have said, education is really important. It's important enough that it gives Congress wide authority to be able to legislate in something like Title II. So Toledo versus Sanchez, a 2006 case, from the First Circuit, for example, had to do with a college student seeking reasonable accommodations for his schizoaffective disorder. It had to do with being able to start a little later, getting breaks and the like, and the school had denied him that. And the court said, well, education, again, education is very important. I mean, the language gets a little bit slippery here, but the notion is it's important enough to justify greater congressional action. And what's particularly interesting about this, and Michael makes this point in his article, when the court is looking at, well, how do we know that not only is education important, that's not so hard, how do we know that there's been some kind of history of state-based or governmental-based discrimination in this area, the court looked very, very widely. So it didn't just restrict itself to, has there been some kind of showing of state-based discrimination against college students or state-based discrimination against graduate students? It looked to discrimination against children with disabilities. It cited the Park case, the Mills case, cases having to do with elementary school children who were not given access to schooling based on their disabilities. It cited Board of Education versus Rowley. It cited all kinds of cases which established almost an atmosphere of discrimination and exclusion rather than this kind of pinpoint, you must show that particular discrimination in this particular area has been demonstrated in order to act legislatively. And that was a very key point because in Garrett, when the court struck down the Title I, its basis for damage actions, the court said it's not enough that the ADA has this extensive legislative history about discrimination. Even it's not enough that there's a lot of history of state-based discrimination. Show me where there's state-based discrimination in employment, said Chief Justice Rehnquist. And he said there's about, five or six kind of scattered references in the legislative history. So not only are we looking at a broader range of rights that might generate some higher scrutiny, which would then in turn justify a Title II damage case, but we're also looking at a broader look at sort of societal evidence that might justify that action. And I think that's really an important point. So where are we left then with respect to what rights might justify this kind of heightened scrutiny, which in turn would justify deference to Congress? As I said, I think voting is one that is certainly you would predict would survive this kind of scrutiny. Freedom from physical restraint, which the court has said in a number of instances, that is, for example, people who are wrongly institutionalized could well be as well, since freedom from restraint is one of those basic rights. Again, why not go with those great late 1960s, 70s cases like the right to travel, the Shapiro versus Thompson. Again, that might be one that might survive this. Privacy rights, rights to intimate interactions with others, procreation. Those are kinds of rights that one, certainly if one were litigating these cases in a favorable environment, one might say, yes, let's try to pick well, and that's a big if, by the way, let's try to pick well rights that are really very well established in our understanding of what's important and go with those. What rights don't survive? Again, it's a bit of a guess. The requirement that you pay $2 for the placard that allows you to park in a handicapped space, I'm guessing would not go, and there's some court decisions post-Lane that have not permitted those cases to go forward. Hale versus King, a 2010 case from the Fifth Circuit, which said that access to prison education and work release programs that was denied to a prisoner with a disability, that wouldn't amount to that as well. What it's going to require, I think, both primarily from those litigating these cases as well as those who comment on these cases, is a lot of focus on identifying the right, the importance of the right, and the evidence, the societal evidence in court cases and otherwise that show how critical denial of that right has been to society, all of which is only done as a way to say, there was enough here, Congress, for you to actually act in passing Title II for authorized damage actions. Now, you know, there's a lot of variations on this theme. What we've been talking about is damage actions and not injunctive actions. There's separate rules with respect to that. We've also been talking, of course, in particular about the equal protection piece of this and some of the due process piece. There's obviously other kinds of rights that folks have that are important, including rights against institutionalization, identified, if not broadly so, but at least somewhat so in the Youngberg versus Romeo case of 1982, a right against being sent to a mental hospital if you're not dangerous to yourself or others and can survive with family or friends, the O'Connor case in 1975. There certainly are other rights here that we could talk about. But this particular set of doctrinal developments, I think, has a way of, let's say, making the Constitution relevant again. Whereas I think since the ADA, many of us have said, well, you know, if you've got support in the ADA to go forward and you can get past this very big hurdle of damage actions, why not go with that? I mean, I dare say that a lot more has been achieved using the Olmstead case with its limitations to get people out of institutions than one could do with the Youngberg case or some of the other cases that really stopped the constitutional development. So in the end, I think where I come out is that a la Mark Twain, it seems that perhaps reports of the death of constitutional rights of people with disabilities might be greatly exaggerated. Thank you.
Great presentation. So, the two of you, the heightened scrutiny happens if you've got a suspect class, which, according to Garrett, the handicapped are not, or if you've got a fundamental right. Who knows what a fundamental right is, as you said, but apparently getting into the courthouse might be it, according to the Lane case. Is it possible that, I'd like to dream a little here, is it possible that when Justice Rehnquist said that there wasn't going to be any possibility of pursuing damage claims because no pattern by the states of discrimination had been established by the Congress, if you put enough pattern together, which it strikes me is not too hard to do, is it possible that the court might ever change its mind? And secondly, are there other methods of getting to Constitution besides fundamental? And if so, what are they? And how do you decide what a fundamental right is? That ought to hold you for a minute.
These require yes-no answers, right?
That's right. Yes, no. With respect to your first question, is this mic on? Yeah. With respect to the first question, it's a complicated problem, but what the Supreme Court has said is that when Congress wants to enact legislation, because we're a system of limited powers, Congress has to act pursuant to one of the powers handed to it in the Constitution. And usually where Congress looks is Article 1, Section 8, but another place Congress can look is Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, which is what we've been talking about today. And the Supreme Court in City of Boerne versus Flores said that when Congress acts pursuant to its Section 5 authority, it has to act in a way that's congruent and proportional to the injury that Congress believes or knows exists in society. And what the court did in City of Boerne versus Flores is, in a sense, made Congress into an administrative agency, that it had to start holding hearings and collecting evidence and facts. It's very insulting to Congress as a co-equal branch of government for the Supreme Court to start telling Congress how to do its work. And it says, I don't have a quote here, it's a paraphrase, but you know, the court says, well, we're not exactly telling you how to do your work, but if you really want to find that your legislation is constitutional, you might think about doing the following, such as holding hearings and collecting evidence. So it's not that the Congress is absolutely required to have hearings and collect evidence, but if it fails to, the Supreme Court is likely to conclude, as it did in Garrett, that it exceeded its authority under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. And so in answer to your question, an interesting issue is, can anyone other than Congress collect that evidence? Does it have to be Congress that collects that evidence? Does it have to hold the hearings? Or could we as citizens start holding hearings and amass evidence about discrimination on the hands of the states and say that that's a sufficient basis? The Supreme Court in Garrett did have available evidence that was collected by commissions that were started in each of the 50 states, and it, in a very negative tone, criticized those findings as sort of not being Congress's findings, and I don't quite know why it matters. Findings are findings. And so, by contrast, in Lane, when it's a 5-4 decision the other way with only one justice swinging, so it's really, almost everybody thinks the two cases are indistinguishable, but the holding is different, that the ADA Title II is upheld in that limited way. In Lane, the Supreme Court says, oh, yeah, Congress did a good job of holding hearings and collecting evidence about certain kinds of discrimination at the state level. It was exactly the same evidence they had under ADA Title I, but when the liberal wing of the court writes the decisions, they view that evidence very differently. So I guess I have sort of two answers to your question. One is, of course, it depends who's on the Supreme Court. And if by some happenstance this court could just be a wee bit more liberal, just one more justice in the liberal wing, we might not need any more evidence than we currently have. They'll just all of a sudden discover it in the existing record. But in the absence of a change in the court's composition, maybe there's some unbelievably minute but possibility that if somehow evidence was amassed, that evidence could be used in a future case to say, yeah, there really is a serious problem and Congress really was entitled to try to redress that problem. So that's the yes-no part of your first question.
Just with respect to that first question, if you read Garrett and some of the other Supreme Court cases on the ADA, you knew nothing about how the ADA was passed or what Congress did, you'd think that it was sort of one night somebody thought it was a good idea, let's get a couple of our friends together and pass this law. So the fact that there were 13 congressional hearings and this national task force and all this effort gets really marginalized in the way the court describes this whole process, in a way that I think is in fact offensive to a coordinate branch of government. Indeed, when the court compares what was not done in the ADA, what they hold up is, well, look what they did in the Voting Rights Act. Why, in the Voting Rights Act, Congress pointed to specific states where people were denied the right to vote, and only, therefore, did heightened Voting Rights Act scrutiny go to those particular states or portions of states. I ask you, how likely is it politically that you could go now to the Congress and say, we're going to apply the ADA Title I against state employment discrimination against only the following states that have been demonstrated to discriminate on the basis of disability in their hiring of people? It's just not going to happen politically. And there's all kinds of common sense and structural reasons why it would not happen. So I think the court's being a little bit, I think disingenuous at the least in doing that. Now, I think, at least as a matter of structure and what could do, I don't think there's anything that would prevent, politics aside, Congress going back and saying, okay, court, you said there wasn't enough of a record, we're going to go back and show that here's what the record of state-based employment discrimination is. I do think it's not by chance that Congress and the ADA talked more about private discrimination, and I think several reasons for it, not the least of which is employment discrimination by recipients of federal financial assistance was already covered by Section 504. ADA's contribution to employment discrimination primarily was to extend protections to the private workplace. So of course that's where they would focus. So I think one answer, Dr. Maurer, is if there was a politics of it, politics could be dealt with, you could go back and say, all right, let's go ahead and prove this. Of course, now you'd be proving it 20 years after the passage of the ADA. As to what's a fundamental right and what isn't, I think one of the criticisms of that jurisprudence of the Warren Court and the so-called activist judges, who somehow have continued to be activists in the minds of some on the left, even though there hasn't been a justice on the left since Justice Brennan and Justice Marshall left the court, is the idea that, well, where does this come from? How do we know that something is fundamental? How do we know in Atkins versus Virginia that there's something about the death penalty when used with people with intellectual disabilities that offends our evolving sense of decency? And the fact is that that has to do with, I think, a different set of facts, a different set of responses, a kind of a, here's what's important to society. It can be contested, but I think that there's, so it's not, I think if in fact the court were to say state owned hockey rinks, at least in Ohio, are of fundamental importance, there might be some resistance to that. But as we saw going way back to the Bork hearings, you know, I think those who say, well, privacy isn't in the Constitution, where is that, I think would run up against a different issue. And finally, can you get here without going through fundamental rights or heightened scrutiny? I think the problem is that, and again, it gets a little technical, but for damage actions, the short answer is you have to go through the 14th Amendment in order to overcome the sovereign immunity problem, unless a state waives its sovereign immunity. And in order to do that, you really have to look at equal protection and due process. And since the categorical side of equal protection has become so limited, it really does force you back into the fundamental rights basis.
The right to travel is not in the Constitution either.
No, but again, if you can look to the fact that that some have concluded or there's authority for the proposition that it's fundamental, that you can at least get somewhere. I'm sure those of you in February, many of you took notice of the Justice Department's decision not to defend the Defense of Marriage Act in the Second Circuit. Eric Holder, Attorney General Holder's view, and he sent a letter to Congress saying that he would not defend the DOMA. And what he said was, in the Second Circuit, there's been no definitive determination that sexual orientation is only entitled to rational basis review. So in the Second Circuit, it's still open to argue that sexual orientation should be subjected to heightened review, and we think DOMA does not survive heightened review. So that was a way to say they benefited, if you will, in that category, that there's no Supreme Court decision that has determined that rational basis is the only review. So it's interesting to see, had we not had Cleburne, or had Cleburne stayed at the Fifth Circuit and not gone to the Supreme Court, one might have seen something similar.
Thank you much. Questions for these folks?
Hi, Michael Waterstone. Thank you for the presentation. I thought it was terrific. I wanted to follow up on something that was said regarding the discrete and insular minority language in the original ADA. One of the things that happened in the ADA Amendments Act was that language was deleted and taken out of the statute. And I think that was, my own view was, I didn't like the fact that was deleted. I think it was done because it was viewed as an impediment to a broad definition of the ADA, of the definition section. And I understand that, but in thinking creatively about constitutional law going forward, it seems to me the fact that at one point the discrete and insular minority language was in there and at a later point got taken away will be argued shows that this group is not a discrete and insular minority. And I think that there are real discussions to be had about whether this is a discrete and insular minority or not. I think people have different views on that. It depends how you define the disability rights movement. And we've heard, even in the last 2 days, we've heard people kind of expressing different viewpoints on that particular issue. But I am curious on your thoughts of how that might impact disability constitutional law moving forward.
I actually disagree with you, Michael, which almost never happens, but it does in this one instance. The ADA was enacted in 1990, and City of Borney versus Flores was decided in 1997. And in 97, the Supreme Court said in City of Borney versus Flores, when it found the Religious Freedom Restoration Act to be unconstitutional, was exceeding Congress's authority, the Congress couldn't change constitutional law overtly, and that by doing so, I think it was a 6-3 majority in City of Borney versus Flores said Congress had acted unconstitutionally. And after Borney was decided, I was actually quite concerned about the ADA saying so blatantly individuals with disabilities are discrete and insular minority because City of Cleburne says they're not, and Congress can't change that rule, just as it couldn't overturn the First Amendment freedom of religion cases just by trying to make it so by saying it so. So I don't know anything about the politics behind why they deleted that language, but I was actually relieved to see it because I thought it gave the Supreme Court, yet one more piece of ammunition to say Congress had acted unconstitutionally under City of Borney when it's being so blatant. But of course, by the time they did that in the ADA Amendments Act, ADA Title I was already out, so But I think at this time in our history, until the Supreme Court changes its mind, there's no point in Congress just saying, you got it wrong. We want to reverse that through statutory law. If you want to reverse a constitutional law decision, unfortunately, you have to amend the Constitution or get different people on the Supreme Court. But I don't think you can do it by congressional fiat.
Yeah, I think, I mean, to me, it was at least an open question when the ADA was passed with the discrete and insular minority finding, whether or not that could establish that heightened level of scrutiny. The court has very clearly said now you can't do that. And I think there was concern, as you know, that particularly I think coming out of Sutton with the whole looking at, well, what does this mean that there are 49 million Americans with disabilities? You know, if we're going to include people with what we consider to be minor sight problems in that group, it's not going to be 49, it's going to be 200 million. And Ruth's written about where that 49 million comes from and what it means. So I think it was less probably a concern about discrete and insular, but just about minority and saying we need to have something that doesn't add one more additional reason to limit the reach of the ADA. Now, of course, what the court didn't say was that by decisions like Sutton and Toyota, it limited the number of people who were covered to, 45 maybe? And I don't mean million, I mean, literally 45 people. And so, in a way, and there's lots of explanations for where that got. I do worry about the deletion of it, but I suspect it wouldn't. I agree with Ruth that in the end, because of court composition and everything else, it probably wouldn't have an exact effect. And I think it's pretty clear it was done, in a sense, for strategic reasons.
May I?
Go ahead.
Chris Glenn. Harkening back to Wade Henderson's remarks yesterday and being on the half-full side of the glass, what would be the impact of ratification of the convention?
And this being the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities.
Given the Supremacy Clause.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question as to what, again, the United States has signed but not yet ratified the convention, if we ratify, right? I don't know the answer to that. I believe that were the convention to be ratified, there still would need to be legislation about it. I think that's right. The U.S. view is that these are not self-executing treaties, right. Which means that you'd have to have some other legislation. Now, whether that would then trump the view of the constitutional interpretation, I don't know. Actually, it's a very good question. I'm skeptical that it would, but it would be certainly an argument that one could be there. Part of the other thing about it, of course, is, the convention does not actually define disability. It lets each country come up with its own definition, so there might be that issue exactly. But, it's a very powerful non-discrimination standard. Yeah, it absolutely creates rights.
There are some extensions of rights in the convention that go beyond current U.S. law, but there aren't very many, but there are a few.
Yeah, and we have many as well, of course, which many of the rights that are talked about in the convention are rights that in our system, in a federal system, really come more out of state law. Guardianship, for example, which is one we've been talking about the last couple of days, which is really more in the states, a function of state law. But yes, there are absolutely ones that, particularly on the sort of economic, cultural, social rights, which our country tends to be, at the federal level, to be much less robust in the way it looks at things.
Other questions?
Hi, Larry Paradis from Disability Rights Advocates. Yesterday, Michael Waterstone noted that trial lawyers in this field are trying to avoid going up to the Supreme Court. And one reason I've tried to avoid that is I'm very fearful that the current makeup of the court will cut back our rights even further. For example, in the Garrett case, after they struck down Title I, the trial court then struck down 504. Finding that the states were not free to reject federal funding, and thus it was not fair to hold them subject to any obligations under 504. And then in a case I recently had over access to sidewalks, the state of California argued that even for injunctive relief claims under Title II, those were unconstitutional. And I'm very worried about whether the ex parte Young doctrine would survive a case under the current Supreme Court makeup. How bad do you think it can get with the current makeup?
Well, every time I hear people saying to complain about, say, the current political system and say, well, under Reagan, it was this, and I thought, gee, when Reagan was here, I didn't think that was, you know, the wonderful days. I mean, I absolutely agree with your comment and Michael's comment. I think staying away from this court absolutely makes sense. I mean, particularly on these issues of the so-called federalism issues, Michael calls the new federalism the sovereign immunity. O'Connor was sometimes gettable, if you will, and O'Connor and Rehnquist both switched sides from Garrett to Hibbs in upholding the Family Medical Leave Act. Kennedy is not a big fan of this. So if you add Kennedy to the four horsemen of the apocalypse, you've got five votes against anything that I think looks interesting when it comes to sort of extension. So I think it's absolutely right to stay away from the court, to look at state courts, to try to negotiate your way out of things that may look not a full glass, if we're talking back to the glasses, but not risking it. Or if you're going to get a case, and this goes back to this question of how you establish a national strategy, really making sure that you have compelling facts and compelling, as seen not just by a small coterie of people who do disability rights work, but really kind of testing it out there in the world about, yeah, this is really outrageous and this is something that needs to be looked at. But I absolutely agree with you strategically.
I'm really worried about the spending clause. I mean, I think that makes logical sense as the next thing for Federalists to be pushing. And it's hard for me to understand why the case law hasn't gone as far in the spending clause as it's gone with all of other Congress's powers that they've cut back. So I do share your worries there. I don't share your worries so much with Ex Parte Young, because in Garrett there's a footnote saying, but Ex Parte Young is still good law. So it seems that the conservative majority was willing to reaffirm Ex Parte Young relatively recently, and given their propensity to claim they like stare decisis, I guess I don't see that as great a risk. But the spending clause jurisprudence really makes no sense to me as to why it hasn't been cut back. So I figure that's just because it hasn't happened yet. not that it won't. So I would, Section 504 is so tremendously important to us, and to lose that sword would just be awful. So I just hope I'm wrong about that.
I would say that I'm maybe more concerned about Ex Parte Young, because I tend to think of the footnote in Garrett that says you can always go there as kind of crumbs for the masses kind of thing. I don't think it won't necessarily resolve it, but the only case that even looks mildly related to disability in the current Supreme Court term was Virginia Office of Public Protection and Advocacy against Stewart, which raises a narrower Ex Parte Young issue. It has to do with whether it applies when a state agency is the PNA. There may be language in that which will give us a little more indication of how the court feels more generally about Ex Parte Young. And if you want to know what Ex Parte Young means, you have to come to the super duper workshop that's later.
Other questions?
Stephen Mendelson, Burton Blatt Institute. Our primary discussion this morning, of course, and our primary focus has been on attempts by individuals to assert a private right of action against the states. And those have, of course, been blocked by the concatenation of the 14th and 11th Amendments. I'm wondering in that context about three very closely related things. Number one, what would have been the result in Garrett if the effort to bring about a change in state employment policy had been initiated not by a private suit, either one for damages or, for that matter, one for injunctive relief, but rather by some kind of an enforcement action by the Department of Justice or by the EEOC? Number two, what are the implications of the increasing privatization of state activities through private contractors? And number three, are there any possibilities for circumventing the equal protection and due process issues by invoking other provisions of the Constitution, such as, for example, in the case of the right to travel, at least in the context of business travel, something like the Commerce Clause?
Well, the Commerce Clause, unfortunately, because of the Seminole Tribe case, which basically the ADA sets out at the beginning what its basis is, and it uses both the Commerce Clause and the 14th Amendment. But because of the Seminole Tribe case, which has been extended to the Interstate Commerce Clause, constitutional power is considered not sufficient to override sovereign immunity, whereas the 14th Amendment, because it came after the 11th Amendment, is. So Commerce Clause doesn't give you an ability to do that. With respect to the first point about DOJ or EEOC, again, the limitation here we're talking about is a sovereign immunity one, and that's not going to go against the federal government. So sovereign immunity does not limit what DOJ or EEOC can do. What limits them is sometimes who's in charge of those agencies, but also even when good folks are in charge, as I believe they are now,
The resources of any government agency are just never going to be sufficient to be able to go after all the elements of discrimination. And I think as a matter of choosing, I think where that is best, where that role is best played by DOJ and EOC is with more pattern and practice kinds of cases. But that does mean that a lot of individual cases don't get brought. The privatization, I think, does raise again, important questions, because to go for it on a due process or equal protection ground, you have to find state action, and sometimes if the state has contracted some of the activities it's engaging in, there could be questions about whether what's going on is still covered or not. That's, and it really depends on the area. You see this like in private prisons and other areas where, you know, you've got governmental functions in a sense now being performed by non-governmental actors, and sometimes they're considered to be state action and sometimes not.
I agree with everything Bob said. I would just add that with respect to your first question, DOJ obviously only has limited resources. EEOC has limited resources as to who it can sue. But I, at least I know where I work, which is a very large state university, they understand that they are still covered because they could be sued by DOJ. And I think that's an important protection for us, that the federal enforcement is still possible. And even if it doesn't happen, I think it still is a chilling effect on state action, at least if it's a large state employer. Maybe a smaller state employer wouldn't feel so chilled. But I know our disability office is well aware that being the largest university in the country, or second largest, depending upon how you count people, that if they do something really egregious, they could bring the federal government's attention.
Other questions?
Adrian Ash, a question for you both, going back to Michael Waterstone's conversation about the discrete and insular minority, and maybe it's a question in sort of opening up a conversation for another symposium, but do we, you know, how much do we want the discrete insular minority view? Doesn't that get us to the problems that the ADA Amendments Act tried to get rid of in terms of Sutton and Murphy and things like that? How much do we want the regarded as impairment, regarded as a person with an impairment view, because that is a more universalizing response to disability and to into the acts of discrimination? I would think even if we recognize that people who are blind and people who are deaf need different kinds of solutions to certain kinds of technical problems, that discrimination, which is what we're trying to solve, is discrimination. And so the larger the numbers, the better off we are. So, I mean, I'm wondering whether we wouldn't want to get rid of discrete and insular minority and go for the largest definition we, the largest and most inclusive category we can.
Well, I think it's an interesting problem. And I view it, I tend to view it pragmatically, that I don't, you know, when I think discrete and insular minority, I don't think so much in the literal terms, is it a majority or a minority or how many people are you talking about, but rather, is it a group that's been historically marginalized? Is it a group that other people in society are likely to treat not on the merits, not on an equality basis, but rather because of misfears and stereotypes, which would be applicable to our folks, or other reasons, essentially, to not play fair with that group. So to me, discrete and insular minority is sort of shorthand for saying the groups that have not been given a fair shake by the legislative process. And I think, irrespective of the number of people that we're talking about, I think that aptly describes what's happened for people with disabilities. One of the problems in Cleburne, for example, when the court rejected heightened scrutiny for people with intellectual disabilities, was the court said, well, look, the Congress is doing all these wonderful things for people with mental retardation. They should be happy that we're doing this. They've passed the predecessor to the IDEA. They've passed the Developmental Disabilities Bill of Rights Assistance Act. They then gutted some of those acts. Mm-hmm. And that's
besides,
enough.
They said there are so many of them.
Right, and where would it stop in the old slippery slope? But the fact is that we didn't stop paying heightened attention to categories based on race after the 1964 Civil Rights Act was passed. In fact, we saw those as reinforcing the constitutional and statutory protections rather than as precluding it. So I think it's a separate discussion. That is, I don't think we're limited by saying discrete and insular minority, that somehow requires us not to look at universal types of solutions. But I also think what it says to us is we still live in a time notwithstanding the ADA and all the other wonderful things that have happened because of people's activities and work, where in fact, all the time, people with disabilities are underappreciated, not given the autonomy, everything else that we know to be true for all kinds of folks with disabilities.
Well, and one reason I wish we did have the discrete and insular minority language is that, as some of you know who are familiar with my constitutional work, I'm a big fan of what I call an anti-subordination perspective on what equality means, that we have equality principles to help those who have been previously excluded, disenfranchised, segregated, harmed by our society. And I'm not a fan of the idea of the sort of reverse discrimination line of cases. And we haven't faced the reverse discrimination line of cases in the disability area for various reasons. But I think that it's important to make clear that this is a principle to protect a group that has faced a history of discrimination and is not a principle that's there for whatever we want to call them, the temporarily able-bodied, to, you know, complain about accommodations that go to individuals with disabilities. So I'm sorry that we don't have that language in the ADA anymore, because I think it's a reminder of a way that we want to think about inequality, that we want to think about inequality from an historical lens and not just say, oh, it's exactly the same thing when whites are discriminated against as when blacks are discriminated against. No, it's not the same thing for reasons that go beyond the scope of this conference. But we haven't had that discourse so much in the disability area, and I wish we could be clearer about saying that there's a why for why this group gets covered. It is covered because of this tremendously awful history of discrimination against this group, and that we want to remind people of that history. And by taking out a language like discrete and insular minority, that sort of whitewashes that history, I think, to some extent.
Why won't regard it as get us there?
Well, it gets you there statutorily. Of course, it doesn't get you there if you need reasonable accommodations. That's a big... a big exception, but it doesn't get you there constitutionally. I think that's the difference. So that if the thought was, is there anything left, which is how I took Michael's question, is there anything to salvage in terms of the constitutional underpinning, regarded as is one of those, wonderful aspects of 504 and the ADA that says that we look not just to whether you have the condition in question, but whether people treat you as having a condition and thereby discriminate against you. But there's nothing that requires us one way or the other to either accept or reject discrete and insular minority by looking at regarded as. So, but it's just, it wouldn't get you there constitutionally,
okay,
I don't think.
Thanks.
Other questions?
Noelle Nightingale?
Yes, Noelle.
Going back and dreaming about the hope to expand the list of fundamental rights, I understand that the right to an education may be problematic, but I'm wondering about a more basic right to read. We talked yesterday about our belief that the blind and the deaf, at least, have had a tremendous problem accessing a right, literacy. And do you think that might be considered by the court, especially in the context of you need to be able to read to be a good citizen?
I think that's a great point. What the Toledo-Sanchez case said, that education was very important. They actually didn't necessarily say it's fundamental, maybe trying to stay clear of the Rodriguez. And I think that, again, some of this comes out with, I think, or comes to a really clear articulation of the importance. So, for example, if you had a case where the right to read wasn't a right you wanted to assert, you would need, I think, to marshal evidence of how important it was for people with sensory disabilities, whatever, any other kind of disability, who are excluded by those kinds of things. And that's the nature of, this is really kind of common law adjudication within a constitutional framework. You only know if you bring a good case and you get a good decision, notwithstanding, as we said, the concern about the Supreme Court, because plainly from their opinions, they don't think the right to read is that important. that's a joke.
Let's just take it away from them and see how they do. Maybe they won't do any worse. Other questions?
Hi, Michael Bean from Rosen Bean Galvin. Sometimes when we bring class actions, we assume that there isn't an ADA or a Rehab Act, or that it's not going to survive. How do we protect the rights of people with disabilities in prison or jail, assuming there isn't a constitutional right under the ADA, watching these Supreme Court cases come down one after another? And to some extent, there are other sources of rights for people with disabilities, the Eighth Amendment, the Due Process Clause, that have long established. Now, maybe this court will do away with them too, which is possible. And frightening, but if you take, for example, a hearing that affects a liberty interest, like a parole revocation hearing where we have some cases, and just apply due process law, but apply it to the person who is subject to that hearing, a person who, for example, can't read the documents that they've been given, or a person who can't hear the testimony or participate in the proceeding, it becomes a due process violation in and of itself. If you take a right to, which we hope will survive, the Eighth Amendment provides at least a right for someone to be able to use a bathroom or a shower, and the person being incarcerated can't, you don't need the ADA and the Rehab Act. And not that the ADA and Rehab Act are not what I love and we all need, but there are other ways of bringing, obtaining relief against public entities on behalf of people with disabilities. And of course, the right to vote. You don't necessarily need the ADA and the Rehab Act. You can sue, you know, directly in some way. Anyway, that's just, this is not where I want it to be, but there are other paths.
Absolutely, and it is kind of interesting. You know, one of the cases in this line of cases that we didn't talk about was United States versus Georgia, which is a prison case in which Justice Scalia said, you know, we don't even have to get to these issues of congruence and proportionality because the rights at issue there, a prisoner who raised a number of different issues, at least some of which the court said these are constitutional rights directly. And when they're constitutional rights directly, there's no question that Congress is acting appropriately in that matter. You know, the first ADA case decided, Yeske, you know, applied ADA to prisons. And so, I mean, on that issue, I think there's still, you know, maybe even surprisingly, given the way prisoners are usually thought of in the society, there's been some good case law developments about that. But you're also right to point out that, you know, it seems to me that this, you know, what lawyers do all the time, you look for the what is available to you to make the kind of arguments that you need. A case that I think continues, it was a due process case, but it's Jackson versus Indiana from 1972, having to do with a defendant who was incompetent to stand trial. And, you know, the court there says that, you know, the nature and duration of confinement have to bear some reasonable relationship to the purpose. That's a very powerful notion, which was very, very much involved in the early right to treatment, right to rehabilitation cases in the 70s. You cannot lock up somebody for the purpose of treatment and not give it to them. You cannot, you know, give them other kinds of procedures and then not give them the opportunity to understand what's going on. So there's very much, I mean, those cases I think are useful in a creative way. Again, you have to know your forum, as obviously you and others who litigate the cases do, and to know what kind of legs those are going to have.
Time for one more.
Hi, Jesse Weber, Public Justice Center. I'm wondering if you've seen any promising trends in terms of state courts interpreting their respective state constitutions to recognize greater rights, and particularly looking beyond federal constitutional case law to perhaps foreign law, where there's a much greater respect for the concept of human dignity.
I just follow my own state's constitutional law. I haven't seen anything there in a long time that's been the least bit useful. In some states, in the K-12 area, some states have had good case law about property taxes as being an unconstitutional way to finance schools. And obviously the financing of schools has a huge implication on children with disabilities in terms of the resources that their local school district has available to them. Under the IDEA, in theory, cost isn't a defense, but of course that's not true in reality. So if a school district has more resources, they're more able to provide the accommodations that children need. But all those developments have been at the state level. In Ohio, we did have a favorable lawsuit about the funding of schools, but then our state legislature refused to implement it, and no progress has truly been made. But that's, if I was going to look at state constitutional law, that's one area that there's been a lot of development at the state level, very contrary to what we've seen at the federal level in a good way.
I would just add that and if you're looking even beyond state constitution to state statutory law, and a lot of folks started looking to that, particularly after Garrett, because that was another option, there's two problems at least. I mean, there's more. But one is that sometimes the state law gives you, apparently, is good at the level of recognizing rights, but very limited as to the amount of damages, for example, you could recover. So you have to be careful that you're not just winning, but then not able to achieve what you want, or attorney's fees or something like that that is going to make these cases go. Obviously, you also have to know who's on your Supreme Court and how things are going to go. But the second thing, and this I'll end with this, I think one of the frustrations that Congress has had with the ADA and with the decisions that it wound up reacting to in the 2008 amendments was to say the whole point of the ADA was to have a comprehensive national approach to these issues. So while obviously one shouldn't reject local options, state-based options that get you something, it still is, an affront to a Congress that was trying to do, put on a national scope issues that were certainly at that level. And so to say back to the states, it's not wrong to do that, but I do think it further undercuts the notion of some kind of national policy on this.
I think that this has been a brilliant, lucid explanation of the Supreme Court, something most unusual to occur, and I appreciate your bringing these things to us. Thank you very much. We're going to have a break here. We're going to have some workshops. The impact of reasonable accommodation on the employment rate of people with disabilities. The facilitator is Douglas Cruz, Director of PhD Program in Labor Relations and Human Resources, Rutgers University School of Management and Labor Relations, and that is in the Utah Auditorium. Discrimination against people with disabilities at the polling place, being facilitated by Michael Waterstone, who is the J. Howard Zeman Fellow and Professor of Law at Loyola Law School, and that will be in the Pimlico Room. Working with the United States Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, being facilitated by Mazen Bazrawi, who is counsel to the Assistant Attorney General of the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division. And that will be in the fourth floor conference room. And we have challenges to institutionalization, facilitated by Kevin Kremen, Director of Disability and Public Benefits Law, the Legal Services of New York City, and that will take place in the Zaborowski Conference Room, and we'll see you back here at 11 o'clock. Well, no, 11:15. And of course, we were both.